Today is Thursday, April 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, yet another twist in the saga of the release of the edited version of the Russia investigation.
He has briefed the White House on the report before providing Congress a copy, which has helped them prepare a rebuttal response for the president.
Is North Korea sending a message to the United States with a new missile test? Also ahead, celebrating Motown's 60th anniversary. It's all on today's International Edition. The Justice Department today is expected to release an edited version of the special counsel's report on Russian election interference in the Trump campaign. But even the planned release of the nearly 400-page report spiraled into a political battle on Wednesday over whether Attorney General William Barr is attempting to shield the president and spin the report's findings before the American people can read it and make their own judgments. In the latest twist, Barr plans to hold a 9:30 a.m. news conference, but Mueller and other members of his team won't attend. The news conference, which was first announced by Trump during a radio interview, provoked immediate criticism from congressional Democrats because Barr will be presenting his interpretation of the report before Congress or the public see it. Gerald Nadler, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, responded in a hastily arranged news conference.
The Attorney General appears to be waging a media campaign on behalf of President Trump, the very subject of the investigation at the heart of the Mueller report. Rather than letting the facts of the report speak for themselves, the Attorney General has taken unprecedented steps to spin Mueller's nearly two-year investigation. One, he summarized the report and cherry-picked findings in his March 24th letter to Congress. Two, he withheld summaries written by the special counsel that were intended for public consumption. Three, he has briefed the White House on the report before providing Congress a copy, which has helped them prepare a rebuttal response for the president. And now, the evening before the report's scheduled release, the Department of Justice has informed the committee that it will receive a copy between 11 a.m. and noon, well after the Attorney General's 9:30 a.m. press conference. This is wrong. It is contrary to the Attorney General's own words to the committee. Quote, I do not believe it would be in the public's interest for me to attempt to summarize the full report or to release it in serial or piecemeal fashion. Close quote. It now appears the Attorney General intends to once again put his own spin on the investigative work completed by the special counsel and his team. The fact that the Attorney General is not releasing even the redacted report to Congress until after his press conference will again result in the report being presented through his own words rather than through the words of Special Counsel Mueller.
George Mason University Professor of Governmental Affairs Robert Deitz joins us now to discuss this further. So holding a news conference before the release of the report, after all this time the public and Congress has been waiting, is this unusual?
I agree with that. It looks like a stage is being prepared.
And trying to attempt to control the dialogue, you mean?
Precisely. We know that Mr. Trump is a showman, and I think he is trying to prepare his reality show, quote unquote. And that's of course really hard to do with when you're dealing with actual reality. But I think that's precisely what he's trying to do.
I would assume the Attorney General has the ability to say, no, that wouldn't be right. But my understanding is that in previous writings of Mr. Barr's, he has said basically he is a subordinate of the president. And there's confusion over that, whether the Attorney General is the president's attorney or the public's.
No, there's no confusion over that. The Attorney General is clearly not the president's attorney. At the same time, he is subordinate to the president. And trying to walk that tightrope is a challenge. And, you know, great attorneys general have been able to do it. Lesser attorneys general have not.
We are learning, at least from the New York Times report, that Mr. Barr has been sharing information about the report. They've seen the report. The president's lawyers have seen the report before Congress or the public. I believe he said that that wouldn't be the case, that he wouldn't be showing it to the president before it's released to the public. It's been 20-some days since the Mueller report was given to him, and we've gotten barely, I don't think we've even gotten a complete sentence from Robert Mueller from the four pages and beyond.
No, I think that's fair. I don't think there's any impropriety per se in the Attorney General providing that report to the president. The president is a co-equal branch of government, and so is Congress. I do believe, though, that Mr. Barr runs a risk of appearing as though he is in the president's pocket. And I think it would certainly disserve Mr. Barr's interests, but I think it would also ultimately disserve the president's interests.
It certainly is already creating a narrative. Why
Yes.
doesn't he just release the report to Congress, to the public, and not say anything?
That's an important issue you're raising, and I'm worried that that may also get lost in this sort of political scrum. There are things that need to be protected in the Mueller report, from what I've heard. Of course, I haven't seen it. I gather that there is classified information in the report. Releasing that information to Congress as a whole, and certainly the public as a whole, runs the risk of compromising our intelligence gathering. It may, emphasize may, I haven't seen it, run the risk of endangering the lives of people that have assisted the U.S. intelligence community.
Mr. Barr apparently has been saying similar things about this report that he did in a case in 1989 when he was Attorney General about the primary summary of that report. And it was not, apparently, he had misled Congress, omitting parts of the Justice Department memo in similar fashion to what we're seeing now. Is that a legitimate reason to be concerned?
Yes, it is. And again, I would feel much more comfortable if a federal court were involved in this dispute.
We also know a spokesman from Robert Mueller said that no one from his office or from the investigation will be attending this news conference. I feel like that might say something as well.
I think it does, too. But it's not clear exactly what. Mr. Mueller has been a straight shooter throughout this process. He's had no leaks to the press. He hasn't done sort of back-channel commentary. He may be saying to his folks, we should not get involved in this. Let the report stand on its own. Or it could be a case in which Mr. Barr is saying, I don't want you guys here. We don't know.
We know that the announcement came out about the Attorney General's press conference from the president, not from the Attorney General. You know, the way he said it, Attorney General's doing a great job. He's, quote, taking it by the horns. That seemed an unusual thing to say.
Yes, it is. But it's very hard to take Mr. Trump's imprecision or loose use of words very seriously. In other words, does it have significance? Who knows? But I certainly agree that having the White House announce this is odd.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. That is George Mason University Professor of Governmental Affairs, Robert Deitz. Well, the nearly 400-page report is likely to contain unflattering details about the president's efforts to control the Russia investigation, even if it doesn't say that he committed enough of a crime. And it may paint the Trump campaign as eager to exploit Russian aid and email stolen from Democrats. But we will find out tomorrow, possibly. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The Trump administration puts more restrictions on Cuba, including U.S. travel. Fighting in Libyan capital intensifies. What Zimbabwe is promising white farmers. And 28 people have been killed in Portugal in a bus crash, including Germans. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. North Korea claims to have tested a new tactical guided weapon, the latest display of Pyongyang's military capabilities. State media reports that Kim Jong-un supervised and guided the test, calling it an operation of very weighty significance. North Korea hasn't carried out a major provocation such as a nuclear or long-range missile test for well over a year since Kim began talks with the United States and South Korea. AP correspondent Mike Gracia has more.
According to state media, North Korea has test-fired what's described as a new type tactical guided weapon. The state-run Korean Central News Agency says North Korean leader Kim Jong-un observed the firing of the unspecified weapon. North Korea's weapons testing had largely halted since a series of tests in 2017. But in late February, a nuclear disarmament summit in Hanoi between Kim and U.S. President Donald Trump collapsed without a new agreement. The Associated Press could not immediately and independently verify North Korea's claim of the weapons test. I'm Mike Rossia.
France's prime minister has called for an international competition to restore the spire at the fire-damaged Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. French President Emmanuel Macron says he wants the repairs done in 5 years, but the cathedral is not only a cultural and UNESCO heritage site, it's also an ecclesiastical one. What will it take to restore the building, and should it be restored to what it was, or should it be changed? VOA's David Byrd reports.
The fires are out, millions of dollars are being pledged, and the political will is there to begin restoring Notre Dame. The stone vault in the cathedral protected much of the interior of the building, but the lead-clad timber roof and the 19th-century neo-Gothic spire have been destroyed. French Prime Minister Edouard Philippe has called for a new spire that is adapted to the techniques and challenges of our era. What will that mean? Julio Bermudez is a professor in the School of Architecture and Planning at the Catholic University of America here in Washington. He says those restoring Notre Dame will have to decide whether or not to leave a 21st century mark on the building.
So I think we could have this conversation, how far we want to replicate exactly what was before, and how much, or should we, have a different level of response that acknowledge today's time.
One concern is the condition of the three massive rose windows in the cathedral. Virginia Regan is a distinguished professor of humanities at the College of the Holy Cross, and she specializes in the history of stained glass. She says that the windows will be examined by a worldwide team of experts, but only once the structural integrity of the building is assured.
They will have to assess the integrity of the windows, and then they'll make a decision as to whether or not they can be stabilized, if they need to be stabilized in place, how to stabilize them in place, or whether they need to be taken out and then solidified.
Carpale Cruce is the Associate Dean for Research, Scholarship, and Creative Work at the School of Architecture at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. She's also an expert in historic preservation and has worked on the digital preservation of the Taj Mahal in India and the Vatican's Belvedere Courtyard. She says rebuilding Notre Dame offers a unique opportunity to learn how to prevent future disasters.
So it is going to be crucial to understand that how can we protect these monuments from any kind of natural or man-made disaster or attacks that can happen to such iconic monuments around the globe.
Art history professor Kevin Murphy of Vanderbilt University in Nashville says the site is important even to those with no faith, so restoring its former beauty is paramount.
Many people who, aren't even necessarily Catholic, who go there and feel inspiration in that soaring space will want to have that sense of spaciousness and completeness restored, regardless of the particular choices that are made about materials and style, all those kinds of questions.
Restorers will also have to decide whether to rebuild the roof with wood or with other materials. Because of a lack of timber, the massive oak beams that held the previous roof might not be replicated, and preventing another catastrophe is of primary importance. Kobe Karp is an architect whose firm has designed and built commercial and multi-use properties across the world. He says even if the roof is restored to its previous design, it will have to incorporate modern fireproofing and firefighting equipment.
And I think that now we actually have an opportunity to take our knowledge in fire life safety to go into the Troas system. So when we do resurrect this beautiful volume and space, we would be able to hopefully never ever have to face this event again.
Any restoration will have to consider both the artistic and the ecclesiastical heritage of Notre Dame. Catholic University Associate Professor and Chair of the Art Department, Nora Hyman, says the cathedral is as much a symbol of hope as it is a symbol of France or of the Catholic faith.
We see it as a symbol of courage. We see it as a symbol of human resilience. We see it as a symbol of ingenuity. And for those of us among the community of Catholic faithful, it stands for the endurance of faith against all obstacles. That it happened in particular in Holy Week just adds tremendous poignance to it.
Julio Bermudez says that rebuilding Notre Dame is an act of faith, not only for the French, but also for all humanity.
This is now a human heritage in which actually the French has responsibility, perhaps more than any, but then all of us are part of this beautiful project of faith in our humanity, in our connection to something larger than we are.
French President Emmanuel Macron has said he wants Notre Dame restored in 5 years, just in time for Paris to host the 2024 Olympics. Some have balked at that timeline, but the momentum to rebuild what was lost and to preserve what remains is running high, so perhaps it can be done. In Washington, I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
The U.S. Attorney General on Tuesday reversed a rule that had allowed some asylum seekers to ask for bond in front of an immigration judge. The decision expands indefinite detention for some migrants who must wait months or years for their cases to be heard. The new policy follows the president's recent proposal to take asylum seekers to so-called sanctuary cities in the U.S., which limit their cooperation with the government's effort to enforce immigration law. Joining us to discuss is Ariana Bayat, immigration attorney at Path Law Group in Los Angeles, California. Thank you for being with us. So is it legal to take asylum-seeking migrants to sanctuary cities?
Legality is unclear, but really that is not even the important point here. This is really just a political stunt on his part to punish his political opponent, and he's using these immigrants as pawns to do so. Also, these immigrants, once they are sent to these sanctuary cities, they are free to go wherever they would please when they are released. So this wouldn't make sense for him or his administration.
But can he legally do it, or is that still is that totally unclear legal by the law because it's never been
legally,
done?
Legally, it's really unclear. He can try, but I believe legally there and practically there would just be so many obstacles in doing this.
If it turned out that it wasn't legal and he did it anyway, how would anyone stop him? Or is it really, just like you said, some sort of political stunt that but that doesn't mean he wouldn't follow through with it?
Well, ICE is the agency responsible for implementing this plan. And as far as we know, ICE has essentially rejected this idea. They've said they think it's a bad idea and they didn't even take it seriously at first. And when the president did kind of push them on it, they reached out to their legal team. And when their legal team weighed in, they said it was inappropriate and it actually lacked legal basis. So I guess to answer your question, ICE would be able to stop this from going through.
They would.
Mm-hmm. By not implementing the plan he's proposing.
And I imagine it would put an enormous financial burden on those cities. But I would imagine also that the president would say, well, they said that immigrants are welcome, so why not?
Well, it'd actually also be putting a large financial burden on ICE as well, the federal government, because they would be the one having to use their expenses to transport them. And, you know, that includes making sure they get there safely. And so it would really be a financial burden on both the federal and the state.
And on the issue of asylum, because many of these migrants, as you know, are coming in seeking asylum, and the president's saying we need to stop it, we need to change this law. But my understanding is that is an international law. Can the U.S. just say we're full, as the president has implied? And is the U.S. full? Is it full?
Well, the U.S. statute is very clear. An alien who is physically present or arrives in the United States may apply for asylum irrespective of their status. The statute really couldn't be more clear. It doesn't say that they can only apply if there is space. And as far as to answer the question of if the U.S. is full or isn't full, that's a complicated question that requires a far deeper analysis than if it's full or not.
All right. That's Ariana Bayat, immigration attorney at Path Law Group in Los Angeles. Thank you for your perspective. Ebola survivors in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo face a number of challenges, including reduced or blurred vision stemming from inflammation of their eyes. VOA's Steve Miller has more on how patients suffering from this deadly disease fight not just for their lives, but for their vision.
Ebola is one of the world's deadliest diseases, a hemorrhagic fever caused by the Ebola virus. An average of 50% of those who contract the disease succumb to it, but those numbers can reach as high as 90%, some 6 to 16 days after symptoms first appear. Patients in Democratic Republic of Congo's Beni City fought and survived Ebola, but they are not in the clear yet. They continue to face numerous health problems, including reduced or blurred vision stemming from inflamed eyes. Roughly 20% of Ebola survivors develop problems with their vision. To counteract this phenomenon, Congo's Ministry of Health has partnered with the World Health Organization to establish an eye clinic in the city of Beni, the epicenter of the latest Ebola outbreak. Dr. Telesphore Mumbere says it's important for healthcare workers to provide follow-up care to those receiving treatment.
In collaboration with the WHO, we need to see these patients every month to check on those who've received treatment, to see if there was improvement, and for others later on, if there are complications.
There have been 10 outbreaks of Ebola in Congo since the virus was first discovered in 1976. There have been 1,264 confirmed and probable cases, resulting in 814 souls lost in the current outbreak, which was declared last August. Only the 2013 to 2016 outbreak in West Africa surpasses it, when more than 28,000 cases were reported and over 11,000 people died. It was in 2014, during that outbreak, that many of the after effects of Ebola were discovered. Emory University professor Dr. Stephen Ye helped train the Congo physicians.
We try to help with vision, we try to help with any pain, and also preventive medicine is also a major consideration. So it's important for us to also to reassure them that their eyes are doing well, but it's also important to discuss with them the warning signs of eye inflammation, reasons like pain, redness, light sensitivity, things for which they should contact the survivor program and their doctor, so that if a problem develops, then they know that they need to seek care immediately, just to make sure that we can avoid complications.
For the survivors receiving treatment, the road to recovery is far from over, and they will require regular checkups and support for months to come. Steve Miller, VOA News.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. A Rwandan albino woman has appeared in a music video, attracting widespread attention and helping alleviate the stigma of albinos in Africa. Claudine Mukurusine has described the video as a spark of light in a life filled with discrimination and fear. Eugene Uwamana has more from Kayanza, eastern Rwanda.
Claudine Mukurusine is a 28-year-old graduate from the University of Rwanda. The music video that she acted in has gone viral.
This video played a very big role because at least many people have come to realize that people with albinism can do something which can be good and appreciated.
For Claudine, This song is a spark of light in her dark days of fears in which she worried she might be killed, as albinos have in Tanzania. The United Nations says nearly 100 albino Tanzanians have been killed since 2000.
On the first day I heard about this, I cried a whole day in the classroom. I used to cry too in my bedroom. It strongly affected me. I used to worry so much, wondering if I am going to die, but I couldn't share my sorrow with anyone. I am sure this affected my performance in my studies.
Claudine travels around Kayonza District, where she works. She's a business mentor at the National Union of Disability Organizations of Rwanda, helping three groups of 300 people learn about saving and access to finance.
I have hope and confidence that everything will be good. I will have a family. For work, I will contribute in developing the lives of people with albinism and other disabilities in general. I will develop my family and country.
The R&B singer James Ruhumuriza, known as King James, composed the music video after watching accounts of albinos being killed in Rwanda's neighboring countries.
So that's when I decided that I can feature her, so that I can give a good message to people that even if they are albinos, but they can do anything that we can do, they can do anything they want to do.
In Rwanda, albinos say are stigmatized and fearful. People think they are cursed. There's no estimate of the number of albinos in Rwanda, but experts say if they are helped, they can successfully contribute to society. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kayonza, Rwanda.
Motown Records founder Berry Gordy looked out at the audience at the 60th anniversary tribute to his groundbreaking record label Motown and saw his dream of making music for all people in the world fulfilled. Diana Ross, who was once signed to Motown as lead singer of the Supremes, brought attendees to their feet when she opened her set singing to Gordy while sitting next to him. Gordy, telling the packed Microsoft Theater crowd at the Motown 60 at Grammy celebration that he wanted his label to bring people together from all walks of life through a legacy of love. When Gordy launched Motown, he gave black musicians the platform to showcase their talents at a time when they struggled to get their records played on mainstream radio stations. His label introduced and helped launch the careers of some of the biggest selling music stars, from Marvin Gaye to Lionel Richie. The pre-taped concert, hosted by Smokey Robinson and Cedric the Entertainer, with an all-star lineup including Ross, along with Stevie Wonder, John Legend, and Meghan Trainor, was taped in February, and it will air Sunday night. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zainab Abdulrahman. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
VOA.